Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. I'm Ted Randall and I invite you to stay tuned and listen as our guest this week is Jerry Marab, WA2FNQ, coming up on QSO. Here at the QSO radio show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. With us is Jerry Marab, WA2FNQ.
And how you doing?
I'm doing good today, and I've heard a lot about you, and I hear you're into all kinds of things. So I want to get your background here. Our mutual friend Mike Erickson said you've just got to talk to this guy. So I want to find out all about your amateur radio as well as professional radio career.
Okay.
So what do you do for a living, sir?
Well, right now I'm basically retired. And I run an internet radio station out of the house.
Okay, but you have an extensive background in the radio business, do you not?
Oh, yeah. I started in professionally in broadcasting in 1970. I worked for a station out here, WGSM, WCTO. I was there for a couple of years and then went to WGLI in Babylon. And I was there for a few years, then left, and then came back again. And then kind of got out of the business for a little while. I worked at a company called Paraphonics. We made computer front-end equipment, actually voice response computer systems, where you could dial your bank and touch tone into it, and the computer would talk back to you. And after that, I worked for a paging company for a while. Then got back into, well, sort of broadcasting. I worked for Home Box Office for 21 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and there I was. I worked my way up from technician to manager of RF systems. We ran the satellite uplink. My department was the satellite uplink. So we had like 35 transmitters on the air at once back there. It was pretty cool.
Well, and what I guess I want to say, when you're transmitting up to a satellite like HBO, you know, what kind of power levels do you run to those things?
Typically, well, it depends on the satellite, and the power levels were getting less and less and less. When I was first there, we were running like 800 watts out of the transmitters. At one point, we got up to 2.5 kilowatts. Now, that's not to say that's what goes out to the antenna. You hit an immediate 3 dB split in the waveguide combiner panels, plus the losses of the ellipticoid out to the dish. But I don't know. The power level that actually got to the antenna was pretty low in a lot of cases, like maybe as low as 25 watts or so. But you got to remember, then you're into a 54 dBi antenna, so it gives you a little bit of gain. And of course, with that sort of a thing, the beam width is really narrow going up to the satellite.
I was going to say though, it just seems like that you would think the amount of power that would be needed to go up there would be much higher than what it really is or what it boils down to in reality. And I know that with satellite communications now and space communications with NASA and all that, use the tiny amounts of power. To the point where it's just all but you think it's ridiculous, you know, from that standpoint.
It's really kind of small. But like I said, once you realize that we have a really high gain antenna, the EIRP is much higher. I don't know what it is. I could figure it out, but it's too early in the
day to do that. Yeah. Okay. Now let me ask this question. were you around when I just have this memory of the guy hacking into the HBO satellite years ago? I was just curious. Were you around when all that went on?
Oh, God. Yeah, I was a technician at that point. As a matter of fact, I think I was a supervisor at that point, and that happened to one of my guys, who's also a ham, by the way. And, yeah, I remember Captain Midnight pretty well.
Well, tell us about this, because I remember this was on the news, and everybody was all up in arms about it. And, you know, some people thought, man, that's the coolest thing. This guy hacked into HBO. You know, and you heard other side of the story, like, oh, my God, the world's coming to an end. You know, what's going to happen if people hack into satellite? Well, you know, I was curious about it. And Dan, tell us a little bit about that. And is it possible even for somebody to do that today?
Probably. He was just in a better spot in the satellite footprint than we were. So he was able to get into it a little better than we were. And that was the whole thing, really.
For those that don't know, why don't you tell them exactly what happened and exactly what he did and the process of finding him?
Yeah, Captain Midnight was rather upset when we started scrambling our networks and he couldn't get them for free. So he put up color bars with a graphics over it that said something like HBO 1295, no way, Showtime, you're next. And he tried it one night, and our operators saw color bars come up for a second. They didn't know what it was. And then the next night he came – that was his test. The next night he came up with the color bars and the graphic on it. And poor Bob that was in our master control room searched all around the place. He thought it was coming somewhere internal in the building, and it wasn't. And then my guy in the back got into a battle with the guy trying to capture the satellite. But and the FCC basically tracked them down. I think they got a couple of tips on him.
So, and, yeah, you know, I'm wondering if they would have never got a tip, you know, yeah, and the guy was located, say, on a mountaintop somewhere. Do you think they would have ever been able to find him?
Maybe not. I don't know. There was a couple of things that they used for tracking the guy down. I won't get into that because I don't know how public they want to make that. But anyway.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, because I don't know how the satellites receive a signal. I don't know if they're able to. Satellite itself would not have really any capability, I wouldn't think, of being able to direction find. In other words, it's sitting there. It's a receive antenna, you know, and it's like a translator is what it is. I mean, it picks the signal up and retransmits it on the satellite frequency. So it's going to take the strongest signal that it can hear, you know. And if the other signal is X number of dB down from it, then you got trouble. You know,
you need 3 dB to capture. It's FM. And that's it. And yeah, the satellite is broad. It looks like it looks at the whole continental United States. So you could be anywhere.
Yeah, I remember a long time ago hearing stories about people who, and maybe you may be familiar with this, but they claimed, it seems like the articles were published in like 2600 magazine or something like that. They claimed to be able to jam a satellite. You know, these are hackers. These are kids, man. They haven't got a lick of sense. They have nothing malicious about them. It's just that they just want to do it. You know, they just want to say, I did that, you know. And
I remember the old 2600 magazine. Yeah.
The hacking has been around forever. I mean, I don't think it'll ever go away. You know, at one point in time, somewhere, someone is going to be attempting to hack something. And those guys all get together and they exchange ideas, and You know, they have a local 2600 club that meets in the Nashville area. You know, I mean, I guess they're all over the place, but and I don't know how. I don't think it's as extensive as it used to be, but it used to be they were into things called blue boxes and black boxes, and I don't know if you remember the, because that's the where 2600 came from. That was the tone that
that was used.
I don't know, but yeah, satellite hacking. Of course, now you don't have to do that because you can get into ham radio, you know, and you can.
And here we are.
Yeah, and you can do satellites. Well, what sent you down the engineering road to start with? I mean, how did you get into now? Were you ever working just exclusively in broadcast radio as an engineer?
Yes. From about 1970 to around 1977.
And what captured you in that mode?
Well, it was kind of funny. I wanted to be a disc jockey at one point, back in the 60s. And I'm sure you remember radio in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you don't. Oh, yeah. It was pretty dynamic up here in the New York area, New York metro area. And for the worst thing, I wanted to be in radio one way or another. So I don't want to get into the whole college thing because my guidance counselor thought I should go to college. I didn't want to go into broadcasting. And I wound up going to college for a year. And then going, wait a minute, I'm going to do this my way. So I went to broadcasting school, and I signed up for the DJ course, you know, and the first phone course because I wanted to get my first class radio telephone license. Never got to the DJ course, just got my license, and I said, all right, look, I'm going to get in the engineering end of this and have some fun. So I applied at the local radio station, and they hired me. And my first job was to go up to the transmitter on weekends, go out to the tower, read the base currents at the towers, you know, and wait till somebody came in at the studio. My first paycheck was $3.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, because I was working at minimum wage, which was $1.65 an hour at the time. And I can remember my boss, the chief engineer, calling me in the office and saying, oh, well, you got a raise. You're now making $1.85 an hour. I forget exactly what it was. And I went back to him and I said, Tom, you got to be kidding me. Minimum wage just went up to $1.85 an hour. So he says, okay, you're making $2.03.
Goodness.
So I was in and out of Long Island Radio. For a few years, and believe me, you don't get rich being in Long Island radio at that time.
Well, I was going to say, you know, because I don't recall ever hearing what engineering wages were in the 60s, but it seems to me that is unseasonably low. Now, is that the case, or was that pretty well near par for back then?
That was pretty near par for back then. Let me say this. I had a station manager at not WGLI. They were great people to work for. But I had a station manager that considered his engineering staff just a necessary evil.
Well, that's how it is.
We were the guys that kept...
Huh? That's how it is today.
Yeah, I we're the guys that kept them on the air. You know, I was the guy out at the transmitter site rewiring the power supply, and the 5 kilowatt would have burned up. You know, I was like, you know, I don't know.
Well, you know, and the other thing, too, is engineers go out during the worst weather. I mean, 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of a blizzard, you know, while everybody else is home and comfortable in bed, but yet they look at engineering as just a necessary evil. You know, like we have to. Boy, I wish we could just get along without those guys. And some general managers of stations actually believe, I think, that the signal just occurs, you know? You walk into the studio downtown and you know, you play music and talk into the microphone, and it just occurs, you know? The idea or the concept of a transmitter is so far removed from their reality. The concept of a tower and a transmitter and technical equipment and STL equipment and all that kind of stuff is just totally out of sight, out of mind. You know, they have no concept of it. And they have no idea why, when the transmitter is 35 miles away, that it takes you more than 15 minutes to get there.
Yep.
Don't get me going here. I'm dangerous when I get going down this road. But
you and I have a lot to talk to in that respect, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, so in other words, I didn't realize in the 60s, you know, but I guess the other thing about radio engineering is the fact that you've got to know so much, especially today. Today, you have to understand the old technology. You've got to be able to deal with tubes. You have to understand what screen voltage is. You got to understand what dipping the plate is, you know. You have to understand standing wave. You know, you have to understand propagation and multipath. Then you have to understand bit rates and digital stuff to the point where, you have to be expert in it. It isn't a matter of just have to have a passing knowledge of it. I mean, you've got to be an expert, you know. And then on top of all of that, all the technology that you have to constantly be reviewing and the rules and regulations from the commission and all that kind of stuff. And yet the attitude is the engineer is kind of a Mr. Green Jeans. You remember Captain Kangaroo? You remember Mr. Green Jeans, you know?
Yes, I do.
You know, he'd carry a whole bunch of tools in his pocket, you know, and he'd fix grandfather's clock. But today's engineer, the image today is, you know, you have a pocket protector in your shirt, which I don't see any engineers with that anymore, and you have a toilet plunger, you know, hanging off your side, and a few tools where you can fix the lawnmower, you know, and that sort of thing. So, I mean, it's amazing. You're supposed to have all this expertise, all this knowledge. You're on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, okay?
Yep.
And they buy junk for you to work with. They go to the cheapest things they can find. They want you to use consumer-grade everything, you know, inside of a radio station. And then they give you these looks like a cow staring at a new gate when something doesn't work right, you know. And you say, well, you know, if you'd buy this, you know. But anyways, how did I get going on this? How did I get going on this? I need a Valium, you know.
Well, I got to tell you, the guys at the management at WGLI weren't like that. We had no money. We had nothing to work with. That was the fact of life. So you tried to keep the station on the air the best you can. They got to see what went on because the studios and transmitters were in the same place. You walked to the back room to turn on the 5-kilowatt transmitter, and the towers were right out back. So they kind of knew what you were doing, and they appreciated their engineers a lot more. But let me tell you, when I was with HBO, HBO is another place that appreciated their technical staff. Because really, when you look at it, we're at the Uplink and Origination Center right here in Hop Hog, Long Island. And everything was basically there. You know, so the management got to see what went on and had an appreciation for things. But I'll tell you, there's nothing like sitting on top of a ladder for 8 hours in the snow, in the cold, fixing a heater on the antenna. Because we had to de-ice the antennas in the wintertime.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, and the dishes. Dishes fill up with snow, you know, and ice. And all of a sudden, it's no longer a parabola. It's something, but we don't know what it is. But it's out of focus with outer space, and the signal is no longer there, and that is a problem for dishes. I don't know how many at radio stations, how many dishes, you know, I've had to go sweep the snow out of so we could get the satellite programming back.
We had 100,000 BTU heaters on the antennas, a pair of them. And the newer antennas had three, but let me tell you, they were gas fired, and that was another thing you had to learn how to fix. You know, you had to be a burner repair man.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, so, I'm at least fortunate enough. The radio companies I'm affiliated with are not like the ones that I was some years ago. And I remember an STL dish, not a dish, but a dipole up on a tower inside of a dish, got hit by a chunk of ice falling off the 10-bay antenna and broke the thing, and we had lost the STL path. So I went to the studios, and I grabbed an RPU transmitter, a Marty remote transmitter. For folks that don't know what that is, it's a VHF or UHF transmitter that is used for doing remote broadcasting. And I connected the transmitter up at the studio site to the antenna. And then I went out to the transmitter site, and we had a spare 10-bay. So I used that as a receive antenna for a receiver, and I actually fed the transmitter off this RPU. But it gave us a signal. It wasn't great, but it gave us a signal. Okay? And I go back to the studios, and the general manager is all over me. And she says, "Why are you doing this? Why did this take so long?" You know, and I said, "Well, we've lost the path. I mean, we don't have a path. And the ice is still coming and forming on the tower and whatnot. So there isn't anybody going to be able to climb this thing until it melts some," which is something she did not understand. I felt like saying to her, "Why don't you go climb the tower, hotshot? You know, let's see how high up in the air you can go in this ice." And matter of fact, when the ice began to melt, our climber, who was probably the best in the state, came out, and he was climbing inside the tower, you know, because he's trying to keep away from, and a chunk of ice fell and hit him in the arm, and it made a gash, you know. But anyways, I told her, I said, "This is the way it is," and she says to me, "Oh," she said, "Well, can't you just put on a CD?" Yeah, you know, and when you got people like that running the operation, I mean, what do you expect? I mean, that's just the way it is. But anyways, I'm fortunate today I don't have to deal with that. But there's so many engineers out there, and believe me, I sympathize with you folks, because I know what it's like when you're working in those kind of environments, you know. And hopefully, you know, hopefully some of those days are over. But I have a feeling for a lot of folks, you know, it's not.
It's not.
Now, let me shift gears just a little bit here on you. What got you going in ham radio? What was it? I know the radio engineering and ham radio obviously are very related, but what got you going in the amateur radio realm?
My dad was a ham since from 1952 up until when he passed away in the 90s.
Oh, that's very cool. Tell me about your dad and his, how he got into it in his early stations that you remember.
You know, I don't get my dad into it. I was 2 years old at the time. But when we moved out here, I remember from the first day we moved out to East Northport, he had his ham stuff up. And he worked with, at one time, a Borrow Johnson a Ranger. And some kind of national receiver. I don't exactly remember what that was. And his station just sort of evolved. You know, he had a DX100 for a while. And then he had I think he had a Johnson Challenger for a while. And some other receiver. And then he, I think he had an ICO 7, what we lovingly call the ICO 7 Drifty 3, because you can follow it down the band as it warms
up.
I
built one of those from kit form. Oh, man. But they, you know what? They were a cool little radio. I don't care if they did drift. I mean, it was like once you got that kit together, there was a three-band radio. And it was cheap. They weren't real expensive when you purchased the kits.
That's right. At the time, he was building the Heathkit Mobile Twins, which I understand are pretty rare, and I had a hard time digging one up. But he built a Heathkit HR20, which I have right here in my shack. I use it to this day. But along the way, my mom saw him, you know, building the kit, and she said, "I'm going to go out and get him a sideband rig for Christmas," and that's what she got. She bought him the ICO 753, but she was clever. She gave him the power supply first. Then he goes, "Oh boy, now all I got to do is buy the radio." And she went, "No, here's this box." You know.
Oh, yeah.
So for years, I searched for an HX20 and finally found, which is the companion transmitter to the Heathkit HR20. And I found an HR20 and HX20 on eBay one night, and I bought them. I've yet to move them into the shack and hook them up, but that's coming.
You know, it's amazing. Somebody who told me at Dayton that we were talking about the flea market. And the guy said, well, this is where hams go and visit their old equipment. You know? and I thought about that because I saw several 753s. Everybody gave that rig a bad rap, and yes, it did drift. But I had more fun with that radio. I swear I did, you know.
It's a great little radio for what it was.
You know, I've often wondered. But now, there were some modifications that you supposedly could do to the PTO to make it stable, you know, or stabler, you know. And it seems like I did all that stuff, and mine wasn't bad at all. I mean, you just have to. You know, I'll tell you what irritates me.
What?
Can I tell you what irritates me?
Sure.
You know, I used to run an HT37. And an
great rig.
And an SX-101, okay?
Yep.
SX-101 Hallicrafters handband receiver was my dream receiver because the first time I ever saw amateur radio demonstrated was Nelson Cosby, a fellow over in Dearborn, Michigan. I don't remember Nelson's call sign. But he had a Heathkit Marauder and an SX-101.
Mm-hmm.
And the first Hallicrafters receiver I got was an SX-100, but I wanted the ham bands only, you know. And so I got a 101. So I'm running an HT37 and an SX-101, and I've run a whole bunch of different kinds of things, you know. What gets me, though, is to get on the radio today and come on with a Drake TR-4C or something, just because you enjoy running a vintage rig. And the first thing you got is some smart loudmouth.
You're off frequency a little bit, guy. Can you get down here where we are?
You know, and you yep. want to say, no, I can't, and I won't, even if I could. Yep. You know, it's that nitpicky thing where everybody, it used to be that everybody was off frequency a little bit, and it didn't bother anyone. I mean, you'd hear some guy on there, and he'd be a little high, another guy a little low, you know. And you just kept talking because it's ham radio.
That's right.
You know. But these guys today with these, the digital readouts, and I like that there's something unusual about a digital readout. I think every radio I've got in the shack except the Drakes have, obviously, you know, digital PTOs. But it's that nitpicky
right.
stuff. I mean, can somebody have some fun on this damn thing once in a while? Is it possible? You know, can you fire up an old Swan 350 and get on without some policeman?
You're off frequency, old man. You know,
come on, get a life. You know, I mean, it just gets irritating after a while. I love bringing up these old radios. I love the audio they have. You know, I like listening to the receivers and whatnot. But there's always some spoil sport on there. And I don't know. Maybe at some point in time, someone will figure out some sort of medicine that will allow them to grow a brain. I don't know. But anyways, enough of my soapbox. What do you think about that?
No, I love your whole thing there because it is so true. And you know, ham radio, have some fun, guys. You know, that's what it's here for. Don't take it too seriously. It's a hobby. And enjoy it, you know, and like any other radio service, you know, we're here in times of emergency to help out with communications, and that's the whole basis and purpose of the hobby. But in the meantime, have some fun. You have all these modes to play with. It's fantastic. You can do anything you want to do. You know, let me tell you a little bit about what I got here. On Wednesday night, I talked to a friend of mine in Connecticut on amateur television. Now, granted, we're not really up to date, and we don't do digital and high def or anything like that, and we're old NTSC, but it's fun. He's now gotten me into trying some of these other digital modes and playing around with some of the new slow scan stuff and whatever. And I'm having a blast with it. And to take it one step further, I don't know how much Mike told you about what I got here. I operate a lot of old Buzzard AM stuff, you know, because there you don't have to worry about being a little off frequency. Everybody's passband is 10 kilohertz wide.
On AM, it's not as critical, you know, so it's
It's great fun because you get to run all these old tube radios, you know. And tell you the transmitter I have on the air, my main transmitter, I built, you know, and I'm fearful that that may be becoming a lost art in the hobby too. But I run a single 4-400. I modulate it with 572s, Class B. Built the audio driver myself. The audio driver transformer came out of some probably 10 kilowatt RCA broadcast rig. I picked it up at a flea market for a dollar. I did some trading with a friend of mine. He had a pair of old RCA modulation transformers that came out of some kilowatt rig someplace. With a little haggling and trading, he gave me one. And that's it. That's the transmitter. Unfortunately, you can't run it, you know, at full power anymore. You got to crank down to 350 watts because the FCC came out with this years ago, this, you know, PEP power limit, and AM took a hit and went down in power. But, hey, that's the way it is. Well, you know, but I love all the modes.
You know, and I guess I tend to migrate to I love listening to AM phone on ham radio. I love listening to it. I don't participate in it much because I don't really have a transmitter that's a genuine plate modulated transmitter in here. And I hate putting a transceiver on the air in the AM mode. I just feel like that's cheating somehow, you know.
There's people that do it, though.
And I understand that, but I love listening to it. The only drawback to it is noise, and that is, I notice that a lot of the weaker signals are almost a little bit stressful to listen to, you know, because they're down in the noise, and on AM it's just noisy, you know. But boy, when somebody comes on with a good signal, and the audio is pristine, there's nothing like it. I mean, it really sounds cool.
Yeah, it's a great mode. And the thing is, if you get on there, like all the guys say, you got to put the fire to the water. So you be armchair copy, and that's really it. But we have a lot of guys that they get on with 25 watts, and you know, throw their transceiver on AM and say, hey, how does this work? And you're like, well, you need a little bit more audio or whatever. Some of them, my friend bought a Yaesu, and I don't remember what the model number is, and it sounded really good on AM. I was really impressed with it.
I was trying to think. Somebody, I think, was telling me, and I may have this wrong, but it seems to me like someone was telling me that the older Drake rigs, like the TR-4C and whatnot, do real well on AM. But see, I don't know. I've always felt like that was like cheating, you know. I have here at the house. I have a Viking 2, and I have a Heathkit DX100.
Oh man!
Yeah, and I've never fooled with them or put them on the air. I've just not had the time. I dream about having the time to do it, but I just don't have the time to do it. But to me, if I had the DX100 or the Viking, either one, up and running, then I'd get on AM and talk. But now, let me ask this question. How much power does it take, do you feel honestly, in order to be able to maintain integrity in your signal, to be able to communicate with people without them having to strain to hear you?
On AM?
On AM, for example, most of the listening I do has been on 75 meters or 80 meters, I should say, with in the what they call the AM window.
Right. To tell you the truth, when I first moved to this house, all I had was my plate modulated Johnson Adventurer. I was running 12, 15 watts with it, maybe. Didn't have an antenna up. I grabbed the twin lead that went up to an old TV antenna and hooked it up, tuned up, and said, hey, can you guys hear me? And they went, Yeah. So depending on the conditions on the band, you don't need a lot of power. As a matter of fact, there's a company called Small Wonder Labs. I don't know if you've seen these things. They make a little AM transceiver. It's about 2 watts. And a few guys have had them on the air. I haven't worked anybody with them. But we used to have a group of guys in the AM crowd that I don't know if I guess I could say this, that they used to call the Piss Weakers. The whole object of the game was you had to make a transmitter, about 1 watt or so. It had to be built on something like, maybe a tuna can or something. And you had to be able to get at the tubes and actually touch the tubes, you know. And there was a whole crowd of them on the air. So, you know, under the right conditions, you can get away with really low power.
You know, my son David has a QRP transceiver. It's a Yaesu that a friend of ours gave to him, and he goes out to the park with a portable antenna. And while my grandson plays on the slides, he sets up in the park and goes on the air. And he sits there with that QRP and makes call after call after call. And he doesn't have a lot of success. To me, that would just frustrate me to no end. You know. But he loves it. When he does make a contact, you know, he's completely ecstatic about it. I mean, it just, you know, like, wow, look at this, you know. And, of course, there's people standing around watching and everything. So, you know, that's the beauty about the hobby, and that is there's so many facets. And one thing that one person may say, oh, my God, how can you handle putting up with that for, you know, what? Is somebody's it's somebody's just love, you know. They have completely been raptured by some facet of the hobby, and that's the beauty about this.
That's it. And I'll tell you, you get into different things at different times. In my ham radio career, I guess I was long around mid-80s. I was almost ready to not pack it in, but I was like, I'm not going to put any more money into this stuff. I got what I want now. And along came amateur television, and it just fired me back up again. and I've been just playing around ever since. So, you know, sometimes it just takes one little thing to get your interest going again if you start losing it. And it's just so much you could do. There's satellite. There's digital. There's TV. There's digital TV. If you want to be a real old buzzard about the modes you operate, you can operate CW, you know, code. What do you want to do? My friend and I were running teletype a couple of weeks ago. Now, I got to admit, we were cheating. He has an old Model 19 that he's trying to restore and get going, and he will. He had it on the air at one point, but the two of us were doing, you know, computer to computer. I have an old MFJ 1278 TNC that does RTTY, but we're having some fun with it, and it's cool. It really is.
You're listening to QSO, and we'll be right back with Jerry Mayrab, WA2FNQ, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp. It. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if say you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And now back to our guest, Jerry Mayrab, WA2FNQ.
The first time I worked him on Riddy, I had it. I don't know if you know what an Ohio Scientific computer is. It came out just before the Timex Sinclairs. You remember those little things?
No, I'm not familiar with that. But you can tell us what they are.
Timex Sinclair was a little tiny computer, smaller than a netbook, and it had a ZX81 processor in it. And basically you hooked it to your TV set as a monitor and you typed on it and it was all basic, you know, and they had a few of their own commands on the thing, I think. I got one eventually, but I had this Ohio Scientific computer. Basically what it was you bought the motherboard and then you could buy the case and add on to the thing. I eventually added disk drives and everything to the thing, but originally it came with I forgot how fast the processor was. The processor may have been like 1 meg or something like that. It was really slow, and it had a whole big 1K of memory on it when you got it, but you were running DOS programs that were really small. And I expanded out to 4K, but there was a teletype program you could buy for it, both receiving and transmitting. You built a little external hardware, which is basically a filter that just outputted TTL or whatever. Oh, that was the code reader part of it. Anyway, it would output a high-low TTL out the back. I took that and I ran that over to my HG10 VFO and just varied the I think I hooked it into the grid of the oscillator in the VFO. And then I sat there with an audio oscillator and said, well, I want to do 170 hertz shift. So I listened to 170 hertz out of the audio oscillator and basically zero beated it with my signal coming out of my receiver. I went on the air with this thing, and you know what? It worked. Don't ask me why. It worked. And my friend was able to copy me on teletype up in Connecticut. When I went to see him, he handed me the sheet of paper off the printer. He said, here's what I got from you.
Well, you know, I recall when I was younger, I had a Model 15, and yep. I had a Kleinschmidt printer.
Oh,
and
man.
And the separate, like, perforator or something. I'm trying to think how that all worked. I don't think I ever got the Kleinschmidt working, but I did have the Model 15 working, and I remember working for days, if you can believe this, on a tube-type TU unit winding the toroids and trying. And I got it working after a fashion, okay? It never worked right. I could never get it completely correct, you know? But I was able to actually receive, you know, pretty good. And then when I went to transmit, you know, the people would say, well, you know, we missed a good portion of that. But part of it came through. But that was a lot of fun. And I remember I had the old Model 15 in the garage forever. And then somebody finally talked me into getting rid of it, you know. But I wish I'd have hung on to the thing because they were just fun to sit there and listen to. And I remember having it hooked up on 2 meters, you know, and you'd be sitting around somewhere and all of a sudden you hear that thing, you know, come on, the motors would start turning, you know, and doing the whole thing. And the guys where I was at, on 2 meters, they were constantly sending things back and forth to each other, you know, like automated. The thing would just sit there, you know, and they'd send something, you'd get it, you know, and then you'd send them something. And the messages would just, like, collect all day long, you know, much like what we do with email today, but it was pretty primitive. But, God, it was right. Interesting to fool with. It was just so interesting to mess with.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the fun part of all this stuff, and I think that's what a lot of guys miss nowadays is it's not so much of a struggle, it's kind of a labor of love to get the stuff going and just tinker around with this old stuff.
Well, you know, the first demonstration of amateur radio I told you was in Dearborn with this Nelson Cosby, a great fella, and I remember he had these pictures hanging on the wall, and I said, what are these? And I don't know. I can't remember now how he did. But he was doing teletype pictures. There were pictures of, like, at that time, the president of the ARRL. There was some different pictures he had. But he also was doing slow scan television. And he turned that on and tuned in a slow scan signal. That was the first time I'd ever seen anything like that. I had my mind blown that day. I walked out of there and I thought, man, this is totally different than what I had ever suspected.
Yeah, slow scan is kind of neat. I wanted to do that back in the 70s and never really got into it. And now I'm sort of doing it with the computer now. But back then it was all hardware. And
I just remember I tuned in this sound that sounded like something whistling, you know. And then all of a sudden, this picture slowly started to form on the screen. And I thought, that's incredible. How are they doing that? You know, and wow. You know, I never did slow scan, but that was something that it really got my attention. And I think one of the things it did is it let me understand how diversified, you know, amateur radio was. How many different things, you know, that a person could get into. And Mr. Cosby, he was into, you know, a number of different things, and that was just really cool. Now, do you do? I mean, right now, what kind of data do you mess around with today?
Well, do you ever do packet radio at all?
No, I haven't. My son has. Matter of fact, this last Christmas, I picked them up a couple of those little boxes. I don't know what they are, but I got a hold of the fellas from Gigaparts down in Huntsville and got them these signal something, I don't know, they're small little boxes and they supposedly will do multiple forms of data. So I got those for him. I think David, my older son, has never hooked his up, but the my younger son Matt, KG4WXX, he hooked his up and called me up one night. He says, wow, this is so cool. You know, he had discovered, data transmission back and forth, and he was just all up in the air over it. He thought it was the coolest thing.
It's great stuff. Sitting 10 feet behind me is a packet node and BBS. I run my own node and bulletin board here. WA2FNQ-4. There aren't very many users. It's used the Connecticut NTS uses it to put messages on, because apparently I have a good signal from Long Island up into Connecticut. And there's now some interest locally in getting the ARES and stuff on it. So we'll see where that goes. Packet's kind of fallen off. It took a real beating from internet. because everybody went, well, why do I want to transmit 1,200 baud, you know, and yeah, it goes around the world and, you know, whatever time through all the store and forward BBSs that are there. But when I get on internet and be right there or send the email, it's kind of neat. There's some interest getting renewed in that.
One of the things we forget about, one of the things we really, really forget about and take for granted, and that is the fact that the internet itself is something that can fail. In other words,
yes,
it can go down, and it has. And when it does, it's devastating. I remember at some point in time, one of the satellites out in orbit had some kind of problem, and I mean, everybody's credit card didn't work for days, whatever it was. You know, yep. I don't remember. You know, and you don't realize all these connections that we depend on a daily basis. You don't realize how vulnerable they are until all of a sudden NASA says, "Well, we've got an asteroid coming in that's going to be passing through the Earth's atmosphere, and it's actually lower than some of the stationary satellites."
Yep.
You know, and you don't have any control over that. I mean, you have no way of predicting that. That asteroid, theoretically, that just passed through our atmosphere could have collided with any number of satellites if it would have come in at a different angle, a different height, you know. And if it would have, then a whole bunch of stuff would go down. So I think it's extremely important to maintain all these modes of operation because you never know when that may be the only thing you have.
That's very true. You know, if you can use radio, that's the ultimate medium to get messages back and forth on. I can tell you, one company I worked for used an off-site mail server. On 9/11, I couldn't send an email to the office next door to mine. So, you know, when internet's gone, it's gone, you know. And if you have some other form of communication to rely on, like amateur radio, you could get your messages through. And that was the thing we were trying to stress on Packet at one point. We wanted to keep it a purely radio link environment, but unfortunately, I think these days that's not the case anymore. But around here, you know, the radio links are up and working, and you know, the system works well. So
I think another thing too that we lose sight of, and I think it goes back to what I was talking about when I was talking about broadcast radio, and that is that a lot of the people in management just just think the signal occurs. You know, I think the general public does not understand at all how vulnerable their cell phone is. The cell phone service is so vulnerable. We had a medium. Of course, in my area here in Middle Tennessee, if we have a slight snowstorm, okay, or even the prediction of a snowstorm, all the bread and milk and eggs disappear off the supermarket shelves in a matter of just minutes, okay? Mm. I don't know what these people do. They must go to the store, they buy bread, milk, and eggs, and go home and eat bread and eggs. Okay. I don't know. It's just something they do, you know. But the thing is this medium size snowstorm came through, medium to small, I would say. And I remember being on the I-40 interstate coming in from someplace. And, of course, we were creeping along at 2 miles an hour, you know. Cell phone service? Forget it. It didn't work. They were dead. Every cell phone went dead because everyone was trying to call somebody, you know. And I thought, what if we got into a real situation? How useless would the cell phone be then? It would be totally useless. And yet we have this false impression somehow that the cell phones are infallible. You know, they're always there. They're extremely reliable. And in an emergency, we can always count on them. No, that's just not the case. And go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, because you had a thought. I don't want to interrupt you here.
I can do my thought later, but I was just going to say, up here in the New York metro area, that was exemplified by Hurricane Sandy. We lost cell phone service. We lost everything. Matter of fact, here I was out of power for 9 days. We were on generator. But it took a couple of days for the cell phone service to come back up. And then in some cases, depending on what cell tower you were on, you'd get a message that said, emergency calls only. Well, this is an emergency call. I want to call my wife back home to let her know that I'm here and I'm okay. You know, but anyway.
Yeah, you know, it's a weird thing. I have a cousin that lives in Brigantine. Or on yeah. Brigantine. I don't know if it's on Brigantine, in Brigantine. I don't know what the proper... Anyways, you know, her home, believe it or not, is like the last house on the road prior to the ocean.
Okay.
Okay, so, and I talked to her, and she says, I'm just going to stick it out. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, what's wrong with her, you know? And so, I mean, a day had passed, and we hadn't heard anything out of her. And I just happened to be on the... I believe it was the 40-meter band, and there were some guys talking, and the one fellow was he made reference to Brigantine, so I jumped in and I said, "How bad is it there?" And he was, you know, we engaged in a conversation, and I told him I had a cousin, and I told where she lived and all that kind of stuff. He said, "Oh, I'm not very far from there at all." He said, "Are you going to be on the frequency for a while?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, let me go check real quick."
Yeah.
You know, I was told the cars weren't moving and then nobody could go anywhere. But I guess if you're there, you know, they're not going to stop you from pulling out of your driveway. So he pulled out of his driveway. He went over to he went right straight to her house and found out that she was fine, that her house hadn't flooded. She was in good shape. And he actually came on the frequency, 40-meter mobile, and I could hear him real well. And I thought, you know, only amateur radio. The chances
right.
of that, you know, are just only amateur radio. Now, I'll tell you something else that happened. I was working for WSM-FM here in Nashville. I was on the air.
Yeah.
I happened to have my HT with me, and some horrible weather had blown in, and there was an ARES net running and all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, this guy comes on, and he says, we have a funnel cloud, or we have a tornado touching down at... And he gave the location. It was at near the Rivergate Mall Shopping Center at Two Mall Parkway and Gallatin Road. And he said, it's on the ground. And it's moving. And
yeah.
I immediately stopped the music on the station. And I said, this just in. If you're in the Rivergate area, take cover immediately.
Yep.
There is a tornado on the ground and moving. The direction and speed is unknown at this moment, but if you are in the area, take cover immediately. Now, what happened was the manager of the Olive Garden restaurant at that point was in the kitchen, heard me on the air because the cook had the radio on in the kitchen. He went out into the dining room and he told everyone to get under the tables.
Wow.
And they all got underneath the tables and all that kind of stuff. And within a matter of just seconds after he said that, that funnel came over and ripped the roof right off that place.
Wow.
And then later, the management chewed me out and said, that wasn't authorized. I said, okay, fine. You know, I was working part-time. I didn't care. You know, I felt like, you know, this was pertinent. This was information. That weather spotter, whoever he was legitimate. You know, the net was legitimate. And it was some weeks later, Olive Garden management came to the station thanking the radio station for their quick response and how it saved a whole restaurant full of people. You know, there was not one injury. But
yep.
it took the roof off the place, you know. And so, I mean, and that was just circumstance. So there was just right place, right time, have a radio. But there's that with amateur radio, there is that immediacy. There's that instant radio thing, you know, at the speed of light, the infant there.
And that's so true.
And it's just not possible with other modes, you know. And you never, like I said, you never know when you're going to need it. We have maintained this radio show, QSO, as a radio show. Now
right.
we have a stream that's up and running that has all the old broadcasts. We run Glenn Hauser's World of Radio on it. We run Bill Pasternak and that group's Newsline, which is an excellent, excellent program. Both of those are really good. We run all the old QSO shows. It's a stream. For the convenience of folks, we have podcasts up on iTunes and on Zune and on, and obviously on our website. They're not updated as often as they should be. But we're not an online entity. We are a radio show. And
right.
Each and every week, there is a new on-air radio show that runs on shortwave radio so that every amateur in the country can tune in and listen to it and use their HF rig to get something pertinent to, at least I like to think it's pertinent. Most of the time, you know, if I don't get in the way, we do pretty good. You know, of course, I have to run my mouth, and that kind of puts the damper on the show at times.
But, no, it doesn't.
but I feel so strongly about the fact that we need to stay radio. You know, we need to stay radio. And there's so much emphasis about, and nothing, and I don't want to take anything away from digital modes and online. I love Echolink. I love IRLP. I think they're absolutely fantastic things to play with and to use. They have their place. But we're interested here in maintaining a radio broadcast that's on air and on HF. And
right.
A lot of people don't really understand that. They just can't figure out, well, you guys haven't updated your podcast. And so, well, no, we haven't. But did you listen last week? You know, I mean, that's just, you know, go ahead.
Exactly. Let me tell you something. And what you did at WSM was the exact reason broadcast radio exists. All forms of radio exist to keep the public informed. Amateur radio, CB, when it, you know, anything. You're all licensed in the public interest. And you did exactly what radio is for. Letting those people know there was a tornado on the ground. What can I say?
You know, I am so, I guess I want to say, I mean, there's so many guys, that, especially young people, that get interested in the weather side of amateur radio. Some of them love to chase tornadoes. You know, they love to do all these different things. And the immediacy of what, I mean, it's so interesting to listen to a weather net and also have a television on.
Yep.
Because even though they have the very sophisticated weather scanning radars and things that these TV stations brag about, and God bless them, they're great. I mean, it's just incredible what they can see and do. But you'll hear a guy on a weather net, you know, risking his neck out in the weather, saying, you know, we've got flooding over here right now. It's we got bad flooding coming in, you know, and all of a sudden, within a matter of a minute or two, you'll see the crawl come across the bottom of the television screen, and what's happened is the National Weather Service picked up this guy's report and typed it in, and it's gone out through the data systems, through the broadcast facilities, and there's that weather spotter's report of flooding coming across your television screen. And weather radar can't do that. It's got its place.
Yep.
But it's just like the fellow at the Rivergate Mall saying it's on the ground and moving. You know, it's.
Yep.
Let me ask you this question: Are you active there in any amateur radio club at all, or are you a member of any of those sort of things?
Yeah, I'm actually a member of two clubs at this point. One's the Orange County Amateur Radio Club, which is slightly upstate New York from here. But I know a lot of people there, so I joined their club. I'm kind of like a downstate Long Islander member of the club. And I also belong to the Suffolk Police Amateur Radio Club, which is a great group of guys. They have a net every Monday night. They run Newsline, by the way. And you know, it's just they used to do field day in conjunction with us over at Home Box Office. We had our own club, which I'm still the vice president of, and I don't know why. I haven't been there since 2003. But we used to do field day at the HBO facility because they had a lot of land in conjunction with the Suffolk Police Amateur Radio Club. And we had a blast doing it. It was just great. So the HBO Club hasn't really been doing anything too much. We don't do field day anymore because HBO decided that they needed a building on our field day site more than we needed the field day site. So we haven't done that in a long time. And one of the principal driving people of field day for the Suffolk Police Amateur Radio Club is now retired and moved to Florida. However, he still runs the Monday Night Net on the local repeater over here via Echolink from Florida. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And we have people checking into the net from all over the place on Echolink, which is kind of cool. But as we were talking before, it's not something that you can always hang your hat on. It's not going to be there. You know, if the internet goes down, it's a goner. So but there are a ton of local guys here too that do the net and whatever on via radio. So.
Well, you know, I guess there's some things in amateur radio that are fun, and there's also some things in amateur radio that I consider to be like staple, and a lot of the staple things are fun as well. But one of those staple things, obviously, is CW. And for some folks, CW is the most fun they could possibly have on ham radio. And that's what's so beautiful, and that is that there's so much diversity in what is, you know, so important to one person, another guy's bored to tears with, another guy, you know, it's just the other way around. Do you do much CW work at all?
Not lately. I used to. Not a lot, but it was, it's another mode. You get on every once in a while. Today I think I'll fire up on CW and see who I can work, you know. And it's a very fun mode. The only thing is you got to know how to spell, but I guess that's true with teletype too, isn't it?
Yeah, you'd think so. Of course, now with these the keyboard ability to type words and that kind of thing. I saw the other day somebody was telling me that there's a CW program you use to send with that has a built-in spell checker. So I don't know how that works, but that's what I would need.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. Everything's available via your computer if you want to do it that way. Or I've got the plain good old Buzzard, what is that, JP38 key or whatever the straight key is, sitting right here, hooked up to my modernistic sideband transceiver. And if I want to get on CW, I can get on that way.
Oh, a lot of the rigs, a good portion of the rigs have built-in keyers today. I don't know how guys that are the CW purists feel about that, but, you see those things. They're handy, I would think, I think what happens is you have a lot of the fellas that just love running a straight key. And, of course, there's these straight key nights. Different clubs and different organizations have these different versions of straight key night. I guess the ARRL probably has one as well, or maybe several.
Yeah,
but
I think so.
The straight key, the art of sending with the straight key. You know, I think once you learn how to send with the straight key, and if you're any good at it at all, most of the fellows move on to something like the Vibroplex Bugs and all that kind of stuff, you know, which is, and those are cool to listen to on the air. I can't copy them because most of those guys are over 30 words a minute. So we got one fella here in our area that would strap the key onto his leg and send CW when he was mobile and could copy 30, 35 words in his head, you know, so I'd always try to stay out of his way, you know.
Yeah, that's true too. You talk about texting while driving. Imagine that. But we had one guy around here like that too. He had his straight key strapped to the steering column, and I think he had a pair of A13s in the truck.
Oh yeah,
talk about power, you know.
Yeah, let me ask you this now. For right now, as far as amateur radio is concerned, when you have time, you know, and I know you said you're retired right now, but when you have time, it seems like when you're retired, you're more busy than you are when you're working. But
absolutely.
What's right now? What do you find yourself doing? What is it that when you wish you had the time to participate and do, what is it that you think about the most, or what is it that you're the most active in?
That's a good one, because a friend of mine said, you know, when you get old, you kind of settle down into having skeds with people, you know, and you know what? He's right. I have a sked on AM. I have a sked on ATV. I have a couple of skeds on sideband. And that's pretty much where you'll find me. You know, if you wanted to pick out a night, you could find me in a specific spot.
Why don't you share with the folks where you are? Because there may be some guys that'd love to work you.
Okay. You can find me on, well, let me start with AM. You can find me on AM most Saturdays on 3715 with my friend Pete, WA1SOV, up in Connecticut. You can check me out on ATV on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock. My beam's pointed north, actually northeast a little bit towards Orange, Connecticut. I work a fellow up there in Orange from about 8 to maybe 9:30 or so. We use 2 meters as our chat frequency, so when one guy's up on ATV, the other guy could be talking to him. There we use 144.37 simplex. And then I get on the Orange County Net Sundays at 12 noon on 3920 on sideband. And we have another group that meets occasionally on 3925. When my friend is in town, we're usually on around 3920 to 3925 on sideband on Friday nights at 10 o'clock. Now, the interesting thing with my friend George, who occasionally goes to his condo in Florida, he also checks into the Orange County Net on Sundays on 3920 when he's around here. When he's in Florida, he picks up his iPad, Skypes up to me, and I put him on the net from here. So it's like he never misses a net.
Well, you know, one of the things that the hobby, I think, lacks right now, and we have a lot of folks that tune in and listen that I hate to use the term newbies, you know, but they're new to the hobby. And even though we have Elmers around and whatnot for all kinds of different things, let's talk about operating. Now, you've been around the hobby for a long, long time, and one of the things that I try to encourage people to do, and I don't hear as much of it as I used to, and that's kind of disturbing, and that is people just, you know, go to a frequency that you don't hear anything on and ask if the frequency's busy, and if it's not, then just call CQ. You know, I don't hear that as much as I used to hear. And I can't think of anything more fun in ham radio than calling CQ and meeting someone you've never met before and having a conversation with that person and finding out all about them and, you know, and saying hello and getting acquainted with somebody that is new and exchanging, you know, signal information and equipment and family and job and all that kind of stuff. But, for somebody that's seasoned, that's been in the hobby for a while, why don't you talk a few minutes about operating? What would you tell new amateurs that maybe have mic fright and a few things like that that a lot of folks forget about that actually exists? I mean, there's a lot of guys go out, they get a radio, they get a license, and they sit there and look at it because they're afraid to key the mic, you know? Talk about that a little bit. Give folks a little insight.
I would say just grab the mic and jump in, or grab the straight key and jump in. You got to start someplace. And I'll tell you, like on AM or sideband or something, you'll always get somebody that's the first timer that's a little shy of getting on the air, and he'll get in there and, well, how's my signal? Am I doing all right? Yeah, come on in and join the group. And that's a fun thing, meeting other people in other places. Even when I'm like talking to my friend Pete or whatever, you know, you'll get somebody that'll just hear you on there and jump in and join the group. Unfortunately, you're right. There aren't people that just get on a frequency and call CQ anymore. And I find that very far and few between. So I guess the method of operating today is if you hear a group on and, you know, you want to talk to them, go ahead and do it. A net is a great place to get the feel of things. Jump in. You can always get a signal report from guys all over the place. You'd be welcome into the group, and it's just a fun thing. Ham repeaters. One of the guys I know here just got his ham ticket a few weeks ago, and well, the story was his boss was a ham. He says, "You get your ham ticket, I'll buy you a radio." And he got him one of these Chinese HTs. I don't know if you've seen these things around.
Oh yeah,
Ching
oh
Kong. Yeah.
And they're
yeah.
And let me and tell you work. Something. They are decent little radios for very little money.
Yeah, they work. I mean, like one guy was telling me a battery pack, spare battery pack's like $12. You try to do that with like an ICOM or a Yaesu, and you're going to be paying a lot more money. The thing with those radios is they don't have the technical support that ICOM or Yaesu or Kenwood has, you know, where you can call a factory and say, "Hey, I've got this problem." But they're almost a throwaway radio. They're so cheap.
Well, you know, and that's funny because my son, Matt, bought me one of these little radios. It's a dual band. I call it a Waxon. Okay, I don't know. Other people call them all kinds of things. They say it's Wuxi and all kinds of stuff. I figure, hey, if they're marketing to the United States and they don't tell us how to say it, we can call it whatever we want to.
Well, there's a whole scat of them, and Waxon is one of them.
But there's also
a Jing Tong.
Yeah, but what's interesting is the fact there's been several times I've misplaced the radio. And, you know, I felt bad because it was a gift, but then by the same token, I'm saying to myself, hey, well, you know what, if I've got to buy one to replace it, ain't no big deal.
No, it's not. And that's the whole thing with it. You could take those radios out, knock them around, do whatever you want to them, and it's no big deal. They're $35 for a new one. Done, you know.
And they've got these little ones now that have the keypad on them, and I see them on eBay for like $40 or something like that with free shipping from Hong Kong or wherever they're coming from, you know. But they're decent little radios. They're great introductory radios for someone that, you know, that wants to get on VHF and UHF and listen and talk and make contacts and that sort of thing. I think, you know, and you like you said, carry it on your hip. If you drop it, In a puddle of water or something, it's not like the end of the world. Boy, when you drop something like a little THF-6 in a puddle of water, you're crying. You know, you're like, oh no. So that's the other thing too is subjects. I noticed that when I first got introduced to amateur radio, this Nelson Cosby fella had a list of things. He would ask folks one thing. He asked everyone that he made a contact with was what was their occupation. And he really found that interesting. He kept a log of it. And I went down there. I was looking at all the different things. It would blow your mind. I mean, there were people in there that were nuclear physicists. There were people who were veterinarians. There were people who were that worked for the sanitation department of their city. It was everyone, every conceivable occupation would come through. And, of course, he would make notes about their family members, you know, like how many kids they had and that sort of thing. What do you think about that? The art of conversation. I mean, what do you choose to talk about on air? And what are the subjects on air that you avoid because maybe they're just not good, you know, to get into those kind of things?
Oh, politics and religion. Steer away from them because you're always going to aggravate somebody, and you don't want to talk about those things on the air. Although my friend Bob is of the same political views, and every once in a while we get into it. But anyway, that being said, that's a perfect perfect thing. What do you work? You know, where do you work? What do you do? What's your interest? That's one of the things of AM. You get to really talk to people. A lot of, you know, I'm not into contest thing, although I think it could be a cool thing, but you're just exchanging signal reports and, you know, where are you? And that's about it. You know, yeah, well, you're 5'9" in, you know, in Abu Dhabi. You know, okay, that's good. But you never find out anything about the other guy. And that's the real, to me, interesting aspect of the hobby, finding people with common interests. I don't know how many people I've found that are in broadcasting, and you talk to them, and you know, and you talk about anything, really, you know, and you know, you just get to find out about people if you talk to them long enough. So, you know, the sky's the limit on talking, and usually you get into some technical discussion of some sort, you know. But
well, you know, let's talk just a moment about religion and politics. You know, I've heard I've heard these discussions break out on a frequency, and there's one particular group, and I can't think of their name. They meet on 75 meters, I think they call themselves the Liberty Net. I'm not certain. I may be wrong.
Okay.
And of course, you know, I guess the way I look at it is this: we're all human beings. Everyone has their opinion on something, and their opinion is based on what they've experienced and what they know. And I don't understand.
Right.
I do not understand. For example, if you are a right wing Republican, and I were a liberal Democrat.
Yep.
I guess the thing of it is I think it's so important for us as hams, because we represent, really what we represent is the United States of America and the hobby. And it just seems so pointless to me that if you have an opinion, for me to belittle it, make fun of it, get on and extol what I happen to think politically or in terms of religion, to the point where, you know, you're going to be offended by that. I mean, and anyone else just listening who has a differing opinion, it doesn't seem like we have the ability to have political discussions without malice. For some reason, I don't know why that is. I don't know. I mean, it would be like, you know, it'd be like someone, if people could actually get on the air and discuss something back and forth without a whole lot of emotional involvement in it, but just kind of presenting ideas back and forth, you know, it's possible you could win somebody to change sides and come on board where you're at, you know. But I don't think you can do that by doing it the way you hear it done. I mean, I've heard fights break out on the air, you know, name-calling and QRM and everything under the sun, you know.
When
people get into that kind of thing.
You know, that's just not cool stuff, though, you know.
And I know you said you and your friend get on and you're politically aligned the same way. You get on and you talk about things. And that's cool. But there's going to be somebody out there listening, you know. And, of course, they can always spin the dial and go somewhere else. But, you know, one of the things that's right actually in the FCC rules is that the amateur radio service, one of the purposes of it, not just emergency, one of the purposes listed is to keep a pool of technically competent people around and on the air and for whatever purpose that is. But the other thing is to promote international goodwill.
Yep.
And I think I can't think of anything worse than a couple of guys just beating each other up politically on the air or over religion or anything else that is a controversial sort of subject. There's nothing worse than to project an image to folks from other countries, and they listen to that and they think, wow, you know, what's, you know, But anyhow, I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I can tell you what my friend Bob and I do, and we're up on VHF, UHF when we're doing it, so it's not, you know, being heard all over the place. But we'll say, you know what, we call ourselves fairly unbalanced, because there's one TV network that says we're fair and balanced, but we're fairly unbalanced. But, you know, if you got an opposite point of view or something, 144.37, chime in, you know, and I tend not to do anything like that on HF, because there, you know, you get into the whole situation where you get the name calling and the carrier throwing and all that stuff, and I don't quite totally fathom the whole thing, because I talked to a couple of people that have had the opposite political point of view, and at first, you know, we'll go at it and go, well, no, this, no, no, this. And then you find the middle ground. You really do. And you say to yourself, and the two of us, this one guy that I know, we look at each other and we go, but why can't they do this in Washington? You know, we just did it here, and we came to a compromised point of view. And I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess, you know, the thing that the thing that I guess I see in that is that amateur radio gives you the opportunity to talk to another individual. And I think that one of the things that makes for a real, real successful QSO, and that is making the conversation about the other guy. You know, if we all made the conversation about the other person, we wouldn't run into those problems, you know. I mean, what's wrong? I mean, if I ask you a political question and I say, you know, what's your opinion on this? Okay, then by God, I need to sit and listen to your opinion, you know, and I need to accept the fact that you believe what you believe for a particular reason or many particular reasons. And then I think the big thing is being able to show some respect, you know, being able to respect that other person. And I don't believe the airwaves, especially HF, is the place and time to have these, I guess I want to say, heated debates over things, you know, or name calling. Matter of fact, I think political jokes that are the target people or things, you know, like that, are also really tasteless, because the other person winds up being offended, whether they express they're offended or not. You know, it just creates a bad thing. And a person says, well, you know what? I'm not going back on that frequency. That bunch of guys, I ain't going to get in there with them, you know. And I think it kind of rains on the parade. It puts the tarp over the top of the ham fest, you know. You know, it's just not cool. But I that's the one thing, and I harp about this. Now, you've been around a while. How do you feel that amateurs can show respect to other amateurs in the middle of a QSO?
That's a good question. how do you show respect to another amateur? I
know this is pretty baseline, but I mean, it does seem to be a missing element, and you're one of those fellows that's been around a while, so I think that you have spotted this, I'm sure, in the past, and I just think your opinion is probably a real good one.
Well, I think you got to realize where the other person's coming from, first of all. Not politically or anything like that. I mean, let's go back to, you know, you get a new ham on the air. You got to realize he doesn't know everything yet. And you can't get down on him for not knowing something. And at that point, it's your job to tastefully explain it to him. I've been through it on the other end. When I first got my novice license, novices used to have 2-meter phone privileges at that point. This was a long time ago. Well, I don't know, you know, this was a long time ago. This is 1968. And I got on 2 meters, you know, new ham, yada, yada, whatever. And I got one guy that lectured me for an hour. And all I could do was say, yep, 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 yep. Yep. And all it was he saw me as a new ham, and he thought he could tell me what to do and how to. You don't want to do that. You know, guys are not necessarily going to have the same knowledge that you have. And you gotta sort of respect that. I don't know. I might explain myself here.
You'll hear a new ham get on, and they may be fresh off of Citizens Band. Okay.
Yep.
So with them, they bring some of the CB lingo, and it just comes out of their mouth. They don't have any. That's just what they're used to, you know. And you know what my policy has been? This is just me, okay? And that is, I don't correct them. You know, I don't say, hey, don't say that on here. You know, don't do that on ham radio. I don't say a word, because I feel like the longer they're in the hobby, eventually all those things will start to correct themselves. And to point that out to someone, or to say, you know, don't be saying stuff like that on here, I think it destroys their confidence, you know, and it makes them apprehensive about doing it or saying anything.
Absolutely.
I don't think they're intentionally trying to do anything wrong, but I don't know how many times I've heard people just jump all over some fresh guy that's just on there, and he's using a little CB lingo here and there, and it's like, you know, why do we want to do that to somebody? Let him go. Let that stuff drop off on its own. You know, I mean, why do we have to point the flaw out? You know, and that's one of the things that, of course, then I went on my rant earlier about firing it up an old tube rig and getting on, and some guy has to tell you you're slightly off frequency, you know, and makes an issue out of it, you know. And then the next thing, you know, yeah, well, on mine, he sounds like he's about 500 cycles off. He sounds like he's, you know, and they're all analyzing it, you know, and, you know, and then some guy will get on and he's got a slight hum in his audio. You would think that the guy is, you know, a mass murderer or something, you know. And I say, you know, let it go. You know, tell him he's got a little hum behind him. And that's probably intimidation enough that over a period of time, you know, he's going to figure out where it's coming from. If it's RF getting in or something, if bad filter cap, whatever. But to major on it and to harp on it, I think, is just plain wrong. I don't know. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, you get a guy that has a little hum on there, and maybe you'll offer him some suggestions. You'll say, oh, well, maybe take a look at this or take a look at that or whatever. But he'll work it out. It's like my friend that just got his license. You know, he goes, how do I do this? And it's like, well, just listen for a while. You'll get the hang of it and just jump in. And he was fine. but that's the whole thing. You know, don't try and make the guy feel like 2 cents. He's a new guy. Help him out if you can. Give him some suggestions as to maybe where his home is. Let him work on it. That's it, you know. And if a guy uses the wrong lingo and he's fresh off a CB, so be it. Yeah. This is what a lot of people have to learn about operating. It can be an intimidating thing when people do that kind of thing. You're off frequency. You don't sound right. You know. Why do that?
It kind of takes the joy out of it. But, you know, here's the other thing, too. I think a lot of guys, and what I've noticed I don't hear, well, back when there used to be the novice bands. At 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, you could find somebody on and somebody that would be sending just as slow as you are. And so you would make a contact, and, boy, it was just really cool, you know. But I think a lot of times, too, fellas don't realize that if they get on and they tell the other party, slow down, most of the time, they're going to slow down for you. They really will.
Yep.
And they'll be very patient. I think that's intimidating, though. I think when people, you know, like folks that really have an interest in CW, they tune up and down the band, they hear these guys just going lickety-split, you know. But once again, you know, get on and call CQ, you know. And if you have to tell somebody, please slow down, then tell them to please slow down. You know, I think that we become intimidated by all these different things. And I think the mark of success in ham radio is not being discouraged, not allowing yourself to get discouraged when you run into a situation like that, a little controversy. You know, maybe your signal isn't exactly perfect, or you know, maybe you it used to be chirps. You know, remember people would tell you you're chirping. I know I have people tell me that. You know, and of course you. Yep. You get your first impression or your first reaction is, I don't want to operate because, you know, this guy just said I got key chirps or key clicks or something. But over a period of time, you know, you work all that stuff out. But the last thing you want to do is back off. You want to keep going, you know, and, yep. and I think that is the thing that I would like to say. And I think you probably would agree with me on this. And that is keeping going, you know, and keeping and not allowing one person or even two or three to discourage you, because there's a mass of people out there on ham radio. It's real easy to draw a conclusion based on one thing that's happened. And matter of fact, we found this to be true with the American Radio Relay League. One guy will have a bad experience with somebody inside the league, and they immediately begin to believe the whole league is like this. You know, and it's just not. It's a group of people, and there's some stinkers, and there's some excellent folks involved in the league. And it's a participation thing. You know, it's what you make of it, how you interpret it, and what you do with it as to how good it is. And but anyways, I think a lot of your story bears that out, because you've been at this a long time. And having a dad that was in amateur radio when you were 2 years old, that's a milestone in itself. I mean, that really set you up. You know what? You didn't have any choice. you were surrounded and ambushed, you know, at an early age.
That's true. My dad did try to get me interested in it, and I think I learned the Morse code up to the letter G, and that was as far as I got when I was, I don't know, seven. But then he backed off. He said, you know what? If he's really interested in it, he'll pick it up himself. I was an avid model railroader back in those days when I was, in my teen years. I used to, you know, that was my main hobby. But then when I got into high school, we started a high school ham radio club. Matter of fact, I was even in the ham radio club in junior high, except we didn't have a shack or anything. It was just a bunch of guys that got together, and that was it. But I started to get more interested in it, and my chemistry teacher was the trustee of the club, and the school district actually bought us a Drake line, believe it or not.
Wow.
And somebody donated an old Amico transmitter, and that was for the novices in the club. We strung out we had a trap antenna that we bought, and we put the thing together. We couldn't put it up, though. The janitors had to put it up because of insurance reasons, and that was a lot of fun. Guys were getting on the air, and that kind of even piqued my interest a little bit more. And they had a bunch of old 78 RPM code records, you know. And I'm sitting there copying the code one day. It was during my study hall period. You were allowed to go down to the club and do whatever you want. And my chemistry teacher, that was a trustee, walks through, and he goes, "You realize you're doing seven words a minute?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Okay, send me something." I said, "Oh, okay." And I sent him some stuff, and he goes, "Okay, I'm sending for your novice test papers." And that's how I became a ham, you know. And I don't remember what year that, what month that was, but I went on the air as WN2FNQ. And I guess I was on for a while, and then the FCC decided to change the licensing policy. They came out with incentive licensing. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
First go around. Yeah, and they said, okay, novices are now a 2-year license, but we're taking away your phone privileges. Well, incentive licensing worked. I didn't like being off a phone. So I went down and passed my general, which at the time was a trip, because it was at 641 Washington Street in New York. I don't know if you've ever been to the FCC up here in New York. It was an exciting thing. You get in the elevator. I went in with a friend of mine, and we got in the elevator, and the guy looked at us, and he went, FCC, third floor. I was like, right. And you get off the elevator, and the exam room used to be down at the end of the hall, and you felt like you were walking the last mile. But I had been in there. I took my general. I took my advanced. I took my third phone, my second phone, my first phone with radar endorsement. And then I went down there with a friend of mine who was looking to take his ham license. And the guy looked up at me, and he went, Mr. Mayrab, I see you're one of our regular customers. And I said, yeah, kind of.
Well, yeah, did they have the very tall ceiling and a lot of glass and marble floors and some marble on the walls? And when they gave the CW test, it sounded like it was in a reverb chamber?
No, actually, this was an old building with old wooden floors, creaky old wooden floors, and the way you copied the code was they gave you a pair of headphones, and they had this old code machine that used paper tape, and the tape just kind of ran through the machine and went into a garbage can, and when it was done, he rethreaded it. You know, it was neat, and you'd be copying code on this sheet of yellow paper. And somebody's carved their call letters into the tabletop, and you'd hit that and rip the paper. You know, it was a scene.
Now the Detroit field office, where I grew up, that thing, it was very tall ceilings, a lot of marble and glass, and they used the same machine you're talking about that ran the paper tape through, but they had through a speaker. And if you were sitting in the back of the room, it was hard to. It was because the echo was so intense, you know, from the reflected sound in the room. It was hard to copy. But no worse than it would be on the air during, static and all that kind of thing, you know, and two or three signals coming through at the same time. But there was something intimidating, you know, about the test, you know, at the FCC. There's something very intimidating about going down and taking that test. But it was a different sort of experience, you know, something that was very unusual, you know, something you remember for the rest of your life.
Oh, I'll never forget it. I'll tell you.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
You're listening to QSO, and we'll be right back with Jerry Mayrab, WA2FNQ, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Hamtest Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Hamtest Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamtestOnline.com. That's HamtestOnline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSORadioShow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And now back to our guest, Jerry Mayrab, WA2FNQ.
No, I was going to say the only QRM we had during taking the test was we were right on the Hudson River. That's where the building was on the west side of Manhattan. And you'd get some ship that blow their horn out there, and that was it. But anyway, what were you going to say?
Well, we're getting to toward the end of this radio show, and I want to ask a question here, and I don't want to keep you too long. But I do want to ask this question, and that is this. Okay, you've worked in professional engineering for his broadcast concern, obviously, years with HBO and starting off in radio engineering and whatnot. And you've had a great ham radio career, obviously.
Right.
For those coming up in the ranks, how do you feel that amateur radio served as an asset to you in terms of your professional career in the engineering field? How do you feel it affects your ability or had affected your ability in terms of practicality, hands-on, and that sort of thing?
Oh, very much so. It goes back to what you were talking about before. One of the purposes of ham radio is to maintain a pool of trained technical people. And one thing is the same as the other. What applied in ham radio applied in the broadcast field. It's a bigger transmitter. And instead of a Johnson matchbox, you got this big phasing cabinet and tuning networks at each of the towers. But it all works the same. Whatever you learn in ham radio will apply directly over to broadcasting. And as a matter of fact, if you come and you look at my shack today, it's like a small radio station. And you go back there, and the transmitter that I built is basically designed around a lot of the broadcast transmitter circuits that I used to deal with. It's a simple, it's a 4400. The amplifier is the same as maybe a CCA or a Gates transmitter or anything like that. It's the RF driver out of a Gates PC5 is what it is, with a different tank circuit. That's all. So it's the same stuff.
Do you feel, though, that that you gained understanding, I guess I want to say, a practical understanding from amateur radio that allowed you to be one up in the engineering field? In other words, because you had pulled antennas up into trees and you had tuned antennas and you had worked out plate voltage and plate current and you'd worked out, the building of a power supply and all that kind of thing. All of that stuff that you did that open a window of understanding in the professional realm?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you something. The reason why I went to broadcasting school was I had all this knowledge, but didn't really know how to put all the pieces quite together. And sitting there, you'd look at something and you'd go, oh, that's how that really works, because you already knew pretty much what it was. You just didn't have one little piece of the puzzle. So very much helped. And as far as in my career, let me tell you, I'll tell you a little funny story. When I applied at HBO, the guy that was director of RF Systems at that point was a ham. And so was my eventual boss that he eventually became vice president of broadcast engineering, but he was just another technician, and then he became a supervisor at that time. Anyway, Scott, the guy I interviewed with, who was the director, took me through the building, and he's showing me everything, and he goes, okay. He says, I'll take you out back, show you where the antennas are going. And they were putting up our antenna number 6, and my eventual boss, Elmer, was inside bolting panels on and doing things. And Scott goes, hey, Elmer, you up there? And Elmer goes, yeah. He goes, this guy's a ham. Can you work with him? He said, yeah. And Scott turned to me and he said, don't leave town. You're hired. And that was it. So ham radio can be a real foothold in the door for you.
Well, you know, I guess what I've seen in the radio engineering department, and see, I can't talk or I'm unknowledgeable in terms of, you know, telecommunications and data transmissions and all those kinds of careers and things that people get into that I know are also very, very related to the things in ham radio that we do as a hobby. But one thing I have learned in the RF engineering department, and that is that all the different things that you might learn from a book and, you know, take tests and pass the tests and you know the theory, when you get right down to the brass tacks, the staple things that you learn building and doing in ham radio opens your mind up to the point where you actually understand what's going on. It's not a matter of what's in the book. It's a matter. It becomes a matter of what you know. And I think it makes a huge difference inability to perform. And, I mean, can you think of something in particular like that you know that, you know, when you got into broadcast radio, that things that may have thrown, or broadcasting period, things that may have thrown other engineers maybe, you know, off to the side, so to speak, that all of a sudden, because you grasp it, you understood it. Can you think of something like that?
Absolutely. When I went to broadcasting school, our class kind of split, and we went to another, half our class went to another school that had real hands-on, this is a transmitter, here's how it works, you know, the instructor had each circuit of a transmitter on a breadboard that he hung on the blackboard, and you got to play with it. The other half of my class that stayed back the first broadcasting school I went to just had blackboard and chalk. You get a guy like that out, this is the first time he's seen a transmitter. He doesn't know what's in the box. He has a general theory of how it works, but he's never touched it. Being a ham, now you've worked on your transmitter yourself. You go in, you look at a 1 kilowatt, 5 kilowatt, 50,000 watt transmitter. It's the same as your ham rig. So you know what you're doing in there pretty much. You know, an oscillator is an oscillator. A power amplifier is a power amplifier. A resistor is a resistor. It's all the same stuff. And a 50-kilowatt rig, yeah, they're bigger. You know, that's all. But they do the same thing. So, yeah, ham radio can give you that knowledge, and that's the whole thing of keeping a reservoir of technical personnel. The other thing that I sort of argue, and it's kind of a little shallow argument, is people go, well, why do you operate AM, and why, you know, you can operate sideband and take up less space and on the band and, you know, be really narrow, and, you know, and you guys are on AM and you're running basically broadcast quality audio. Yes. Take an AMer, put him in a broadcast station. He's seen an AM transmitter and knows how it works because his ham rig is exactly the same, and chances are he built it himself. Yeah. where somebody that doesn't quite have that knowledge would have to work up to it. You know, you can't. I don't know. Am I making any sense?
Absolutely. And I think that it's the practical understanding. You know, you look at something and you recognize it. It's an old friend. Oh,
yeah.
You know, I heard a guy on AM the other day talking about he had built up his own rig. He was using PDM modulation and all that kind of thing. And see, this is an old friend to him. He understands it. He built it. You know, he studied and created a circuit or copied a circuit that someone else had. And he's learned from that. But he has a firsthand knowledge about it that an engineer that has just graduated from engineering school just doesn't have that. Doesn't, you know, he can't relate to that. He will eventually, you know, but it'll take the guy a long time to get where the ham is. And yep. The same thing is true with antennas. I mean, if you've tuned antennas, built antennas, you get into the broadcast arena, it's the same thing. You know, it's exactly the same thing, you know. So
it's exactly the same thing.
Well, you know, we're go ahead.
What? No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, well, even with AM, you know, as it is, we even played around with AM stereo. It was something to do. We started back in the 80s when AM stereo was first introduced. I have a system I can put on my ham transmitter now. That's sort of a pseudo CQAM. It's really more of if you remember the old Magnavox system. But my friend went out and built himself up an independent sideband exciter like the Con system, and he put it on the air, and it's just interesting to hear. He can run AM, he can run single sideband, double sideband suppressed, double sideband no carrier, single sideband, you know, whatever with carrier, whatever he wants to run out of his exciter. And it's cool, but he brings it up and, you know, drives the old 813s with it or whatever, and he's an independent sideband stereo if he wants to be.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody running power side on
nobody's run power side yet.
But that's something that could be done. You know, it could be done and could be done just, you know, in fun and in technology. But we're out of time, and I really, really appreciate you coming on board with us and talking. Folks have gotten to know you now, and they know all about you, and they've been able to hear me kind of pick your brain. And once again, now you have a website that would might be kind of cool for folks to go up and look at your website. Why don't you talk about that for a minute or two here because we come to a close here.
Yeah, if you want to see my junk, it's at www.wa2fnq.com. That's Whiskey America 2, Foxtrot, November, Quebec. And I pretty much put everything I've done up on the website. From packet radio to AM to AM stereo, sideband, whatever. It's all there. So it's an interesting site, and there's some links to some other sites. If you want to look at some big transmitters, you go over to Jim Hawkins' broadcast and technology page. I have a link on that. Down at the bottom of my page. I have a question for you. Are you still involved with WSM at all?
No, not at all. I was working there some years back, and now I do engineering for another radio group here in the Nashville area.
Oh, okay. Because the rumor is they want to go back AM stereo, go CQAM again.
I heard that. I don't know if there's any truth to it, but I have heard it. And, you know, the other day, I happened to go into a Goodwill store, and sitting on the shelf was an AM-FM tuner that had AM stereo. I cannot believe this, but it was there. They were selling it for $9. So,
what a lot of people don't realize, you go out and you buy an HD radio, some of them will automatically fall into decoding CQAM on an AM stereo station, because I think the chipset is the same, and it's more effort to design it out of the radio than just not tell anybody that's there.
Really? Well, we'll have to have folks check that out. Is it any particular model of HD radio, or is it all of them, or some of them, or do you know?
It's just a handful of them. I know some of the Sangion radios do it. I know the I think the old Radio Shack Acurion used to do it. And it's just interesting that that's there. And everybody always said, you know, you should run HD on the AM band, HD during the day, CQAM at night. But and that would have been a perfect solution for everything. But yeah, they're so people. I remember I was at an NAB radio show a few years ago, many years ago actually, and the guy goes, "I've never seen an AM radio." And I pulled out a little Sony SRF-42 out of my bag and I showed it to him. But I never thought at that point, you know, the guy had an HD radio there. I should have gone right there.
There you go. Absolutely. Well, listen, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on board. You'll have to come back. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of QSO. We invite you to tune in again next week, same time, same station, for another QSO. And a very special thanks to our guest this week, Jerry Mayrab, WA2FNQ.